Hello and welcome to the Providence College Podcast. I'm Michael Hagan from the class of 2015, and I'm joined by producer Chris Judge of the class of 2005. Our guest today is Marcelino D'Ambrogio of the class of 1977, whose book, Jesus, The Way, the Truth, and the Life, and a corresponding study guide, were published by Ascension Press in 2020. Marcelino is a leader in Catholic media, heading the Crossroads Initiative, and a scholar and teacher of Catholic theology. He's known to many as Dr. Italy, and he grew up a short walk from Providence College near LaSalle Academy. Marcelino, thanks for joining us.
Michael, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So more ink has been spilled over Jesus than just about any figure in human history. What makes your book unique among texts about Jesus of Nazareth?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that it is not the last word, and it can't possibly be the last word. I'm very upfront about it. Jesus is a real live human being, a man who walked along the dusty roads between Galilee and Jerusalem 2,000 years ago in a very specific place and time. But at the same time, I believe, as the Catholic Church believes, that he is God incarnate. And if that's the case, then there's more to him than can possibly be captured by anyone. And that's why we even have four Gospels. We don't have just one inspired account. We have four different accounts, and they're almost like four different TV cameras, you know, at a PC basketball game. You need a lot of different angles to try to get some sort of objective perspective on the game, right? So what's unique about this book, though, I think, is that I'm a scholar. But before I was a scholar, I was a kid who was a rock and roll musician looking for adventure. And I found a greater adventure in Christ. Even though I was brought up Catholic, it wasn't really the heart of my life. Back when before I went to PC, I was already playing professional music. And so Jesus came alive to me at age 16, and I've been following ever since as a disciple, but also I was a communicator, popular communicator, as a musician, as a guy who spoke to a crowd on stage, how to engage a crowd, had to speak in very non-academic language. I think a lot of times academicians can be so academic that people think they're deep, but can't really understand them and certainly can't apply what they say to real life. So this picture of Jesus really synthesizes a lot of recent scholarship, but it doesn't in a way that really packages it to be consumed and to be enjoyed by anybody. And so the book is written for the Catholic who wants to go deeper, but it's also written for someone who just wants to kind of find out who this figure is, who doesn't necessarily believe that he is anybody, except an important figure in history, perhaps for some people, but would like to really discover him. So I think the book is kind of unique in that respect, in that it's deep and yet very accessible and life-giving.
So when did you decide to begin your project, and how did you determine the scope of it?
Well, first, I just want to say that this project is owned by Ascension Press, and that's a Catholic press that's done an amazing job at getting more Catholics in the English-speaking world reading the Bible than probably any publisher, maybe any organization. They've done an amazing job over the last 20 years, honestly. And one of the first big things that I did with them was write a guide to Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. And rather than being a short little track, it was about 90-100-page short book Q&A format. And it was actually done in close coordination with the release of the movie, and it sold over a million copies. Lots of people. It was the very first Catholic book out there, I think, that was bought in large quantities and given away for very small amount of money. And recently, there's some other folks who do that kind of thing. But anyway, that was their launch, and they've been really an awesome force in the church. So anyway, I'd been talking to them about doing a book, and they said, you know what we really need? We've done a lot of Bible studies on books of the Bible, an overview of the whole Bible, a study on Matthew, a study on John. We don't have just a study on the person and ministry and teaching of Jesus. And do you think you might be down for that? And so I said, absolutely, because really, honestly and truly, with Catholics, there's a problem. We have such a rich faith that many Catholics don't know where to start when it comes to talking about what the Catholic faith's about. And a lot of times we lose the center in all the peripheral stuff, church politics, particular issues of canon law or issues of you know, doctrine like the Eucharist, which is so important. But obviously, the Eucharist goes back to a person, to Jesus. And so we got to center and recenter in the person of Jesus. That's really what the Second Vatican Council was about. And that's been a passion of mine. That's what the Crossroads Initiative has been about since I founded it with some other guys back in the 1980s. So, you know, we want to bring people to a real encounter with Jesus. And that happens, has to happen over and over again. It doesn't happen just once in your life. So anyway, I said, yeah, let's do it. And so I partnered with a few other guys, and this book is a standalone, but it's done in conjunction with videos, a 10-part video series that we shot in the Holy Land. I was joined by Jeff Cavins, Dr. Edward Stree, and it's a very conversational, much. It's almost like a travelogue, a Bible study in a travelogue format. So it's very vivid, very, very much, very earthy. We're eating Middle Eastern food. We're talking to Middle Eastern people. We're going through the sites and talking about a lot of the content that made its way into this book. So the book is in conjunction with this study. And that's how the study came to be. It really was a conversation, a passion of mine, a longstanding passion of mine, a need of Ascension Press to come up with something like this. And it's been, I think, the best-selling Bible study of Ascension Press since it was released in 2020, despite the pandemic and all the problems of supply chain and lockdowns and all that stuff. It's outsold anything that they've ever done, I think.
That's remarkable. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And I should mention to our audience that we will include links to Marcelino's study, both a link to purchase the book and the study guide, as well as to access the videos in our show notes. So be sure to check there if you're interested in Dr. D'Ambrosio's project. So tell me a little bit about what audiences you had in mind when you wrote this book.
Okay, well, there's a dual purpose in almost anything I do, and Ascension Press has its purpose. And so let me just say, Ascension Press has a market and a group of Catholic people around the English-speaking world who love to do small group studies. And they're Catholics who are committed already. They're more than usually the typical Sunday churchgoer. So that's Ascension's audience, and we wanted to give them something that would really feed them and help them to grow in their relationship with Jesus. So that's Ascension's target market. But I wrote the book and we did the study to reach way beyond that target market to really, I had in mind that this could be read by committed Catholics who believe in Jesus. It could bring them much further than they've ever been before in their relationship with him. But it would give them a tool to give away to relatives who haven't been going to church or friends who are Hindu, Buddhist, unchurched, who want to know more about this figure of Jesus of Nazareth. And so we deal with, at the very beginning, with some questions like, you know, did he ever exist? Do we ever know that he exists? Some people say he didn't, you know, and why do we trust the Gospels? Why are they historically reliable? Or are they just fables? Or, you know, how do we deal with these things? So these are questions that anyone has, and I think they're important questions. So we deal with those. So in other words, people can pick up this book. I wanted this book to assume nothing. I wanted people to be able to pick it up and delve in, dive in, and really encounter Christ as a person, as the man from Nazareth, whether they come from a Christian Catholic background or not.
Now, how did your experience and education at Providence College come to bear on your project?
Well, I have to tell you that I had this conversion in my life when I was 16. And during that time, very soon after, I got to know a young priest, Father Giles Dimmock from PC, who taught theology. And so my friendship with him began. I began learning from him before he was ever my first theology professor, which he became. So 2 years later, I start studying theology and humanities at Providence College, and he's my first professor. So he had a huge impact on me. And what I love about Giles, Father Giles is now retired. He's still very much with us, but and I keep in touch with him still. He was a frequent guest at our family table in Providence when I lived with my parents, and we've continued to get together over the years. But anyway, Father Giles is remarkably learned, but at the same time, very down to earth. And I was shocked that in his class, I could sit and retain what he said, of course I took notes and of course I did some study, but I didn't have to really study hard because he made his lecture so interesting and so vivid that it was just easy to remember. So he was a model for me in terms of a teacher and a writer. Although I didn't read his writings, I wanted to write the same way that he delivered. And so that's part of my inspiration that leads to this book. Yeah.
That's interesting. We have something in common there. And I'm sure it's a different Father Giles, but I was baptized by a Father Giles who was actually a high school teacher of my father. Wow. Father Giles has had a huge formative influence on the faith life of my family. So that's a funny coincidence. So besides Father Giles, are there any other professors or anyone else, faculty, staff, neighbors, friends from your time at Providence College whose fingerprints can be found in your work?
Yeah, I would say Father Dominic Rover was taught spirituality, and I took a course. I was in the honors program, and so it was a small group discussion sort of a course, and it was really very influential. He had a great impact on me for sure, and both he and Father Giles were very deep men of prayer. Now, all Dominicans should be, and all priests should be, and all theology professors should be. But the fact is, they're not always. And, you know, so you really get a sense of holiness and of a profound prayer from both of these men, but in a way that is not off-putting. It's very attractive. So Father Rover was also an influencer in my life. I was actually in the House of Formation program for the Diocese of Providence. So a number of diocesan priests were professors at PC, and they also had an influence on me. Father Robert Randall, diocesan priest, Father Bob Heyman. So they were important as well.
Another coincidence, I've taken Father Heyman.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, taught me immigration history, actually, in the grad program here.
Excellent. Excellent. I had him for American history, undergrad American history. And he was really a good man.
Yeah, excellent.
And I'm a historical theologian. So my approach to theology is from the vantage point of historical development. And he definitely influenced me there.
So you arrived at Providence College in the fall of 1973. Now, it wasn't a very long trip because, like I said, you grew up right down the street near LaSalle Academy. But nonetheless, you arrive in the fall of 1973. The last draft call for the Vietnam War was made only months before. The college was newly coeducational. What was it like starting your college education in the wake of such turbulent and transformative events?
Well, they were turbulent events for sure. And I was very much involved in a lot of things back in the 70s in terms of the Vietnam War. Although I have no love for communism, I was very concerned about the corruption of the Vietnamese government and the futility of the war. So, I kind of participated in that movement, also in the environmental movement, the very beginning, the first Earth Day. So I was part of a lot of things prior to coming to Providence College. And I remember the last draft lottery. And fortunately, my number was a low number. So yeah, it was a turbulent time for sure. It was a delightful time, however, to come to Providence College. It was an exciting time. You know, a lot of folks now look back from the point of view of the church, you know, it was a turbulent time because it was post-Vatican II time. And there's a lot of folks who look back on the 70s and see the 70s as a really terrible time in the life of the church, with bad catechesis and very shallow spirituality and all that. It's kind of fashionable right now to have that opinion. But there were crazy things going on for sure. But there were a lot of exciting things going on in the life of the church during this time. I was involved in what I think to be, to this day, a very important social justice movement was support for American farm workers. And I was very much a part of that movement. And it was beautiful to see a movement that really, in my mind, was spiritual. It was not simply political or simply economic, of solidarity of people in the church with migrant farm workers in California who are struggling. That was a good thing. But spiritually, it was amazing what was going on, I think, during that time. The Curcio movement, for many, many Catholics in the 1960s and 70s, going to a Curcio or a junior version, a search, was the first encounter they really had with Jesus as a person. in a conscious way. And also the first time they ever shared their faith or heard other Catholics share their faith, you know, for many of us, we had doctrine to believe and we went to church, but sharing our faith with one another and sharing our struggles and our adventure of trying to live out the gospel with other people, that was very unusual. We were very, very closed-lipped and private about our faith typically, but there was a newness in the air about an excitement of following Jesus. And I experienced that doing my first search just before I came to Providence College, which is Junior Cursillo. I also experienced the charismatic movement, which was very alive in Providence. It was a center of the charismatic movement, and it was beautifully integrated with the church. And spirituality and the sacraments and contemplation. And Father Giles Dimmick from BC was a leader in that movement. So anyway, it was an exciting time of discovery. Rather than I don't remember it as a horrible time, but really as kind of an exciting time with good new things happening.
So did your music intersect with your activism or with your spirituality and faith at all in those days?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think as a secular rock musician, the closest I came to it intersecting was being behind doing a large benefit concert and dance, where all the proceeds were donated to this is a long time ago, but you know, there was a little country or a little section called Biafra. It's not a country anymore, but there was a struggle for independence and there was tremendous amount of famine. So anyway, we raised money for starving kids in Africa. So that's as close as rock and roll came to activism. I would say, my music, I ended up using music after my conversion, using it in praise and worship of God. So that was part of life in the 1970s for me and my time as a student at Providence College, playing the bass, the upright bass at Mass was kind of a great thing.
So nowadays you run the Crossroads Initiative, which you mentioned, and you're also a frequent world traveler. Can you say a little bit about your work in Catholic media and evangelization?
Sure. I'll start with the music connection because we were just talking about that. Back in the 80s, when I wanted to do college evangelization, I had moved after being an undergrad at PC. I moved to Baltimore. I was doing grad work in DC.
Another connection?
Yeah.
My hometown.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I lived first up in the Towson, Cockeysville area, then down in, up in Towson and Cockeysville, I was doing work with students at Towson State University, at Loyola University. It was basically evangelistic outreach. It was campus ministry. We were trying to attract kids to events, voluntary events. Now it's hard to get students to show up for a class in the evening after they've been in classes all day. So we ended up doing a coffee house sort of music experience because me and some other guys who are former rock musicians, we figured, okay, we'll do it. We'll put a band together and we'll talk between songs and we'll have food. College students always love food for free. So anyway, we began this event and we called it Crossroads, and that grew into a band. And then we ended up traveling and then it grew into a 501c3 and a ministry. But the idea of Crossroads really is a creative sharing of the word of God through storytelling, through music, through art, through media. So we were some of the first to actually have a Catholic website back in 2003. There weren't that many, and we were one of the first. So we wanted to make the richness of the Catholic tradition available to people online. We've been doing that ever since. And the website that we have now has thousands of pages of searchable things by me, but audio, video, and writing commentary on gospel passages, but also some great tidbits, some great jewels and gems from the Catholic tradition. Bite-sized, easy to understand, you know, the kind of like the fathers and the saints' greatest hits, brought to you by the Crossroads Initiative. So those are some things we have on the site. Anyway, that's been, we've continued to be creative, and that's why we got into radio. I was doing Catholic radio in the 70s in Providence with a local radio host before there were any Catholic radio networks. Father John Randall, a diocesan priest, was a guy that was doing radio. And myself and the other co-founder of Crossroads began doing a radio show with him. So that's really cool. And then when EWTN started, we were there helping out with music and stuff. And so anyway, we've been using whatever means we can, partnering with whoever we can to get the gospel message out there in an attractive, creative sort of a fashion.
So how did you come to be known as Dr. Italy?
Well, when I was in Providence, Michael. The name Marcellino was not that weird because, you know, there's a lot of people with names like Arturo, and there's last names like, you know, my friends' last names were like Procaccini, you know, Guglielmino, Famigliati. You know, I had all these friends with names like that. But then I moved to Texas and I say, hey, I'm Marcellino D'Ambrosio. Have anything shorter for that? You know? So anyway, I when it came time to do a website and have to put a URL out on the radio where people have to listen to it and get it, or they had to see it on a television screen and they had 5, 10, 15 seconds to copy it down or remember it, MarcellinoD'Ambrosio.com was not going to work. So I bought the domain DrItaly.com, very short, DrItaly.com, hard to misspell. You can remember I'm a doctor. You remember I'm Italian. You know, that's all you need to remember. So it began as a URL, and then radio hosts and podcast hosts and MCs at live events, they saw that in the bio and they began calling me that as a way to avoid mispronouncing my name. So anyway, that's how I got Dr. Italy.
I've been mispronouncing your name. I've been doing the C as like an S sound, and I'm hearing it's like a CH sound, right?
I can't believe you did that, Michael, and you're from Providence. You ought to know better, right? Even if your last name is not Italian. No, it's okay, no problem. You wouldn't believe. I've gotten Maraschino, Marciano, Cappuccino, Trampolino, so, you know, so Marcellino is like the least of my problems, really.
So returning to your book, your title is really, it's your central claim, Jesus, the way, the truth, and the life, which is, of course, taken from John's gospel, in which Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Say a little bit about how you decided on this title and its significance in your work.
Okay, well, I'm going to be really honest up front and say this. The publisher decided on the title. Okay. But number two, when the publisher decided on the title, I kind of put the content. I really pondered and prayed over the title decided to organize the content in terms of the title and really come at it in maybe a different way. The way, the truth, and the life is so often repeated that it can be trite and people really don't ponder it very much. But I just tell you, early Christianity was called the way. And you can see this in the Acts of the Apostles, or the road. And the whole idea really is, it's not about Christianity and Catholicism. I don't like to use the term Catholicism. And the reason, you don't find it in the Catechism, you don't find it in any of our documents officially, but our faith is not an ism, and many people think it is. People reduce our faith to a belief system or a moral code, but it's a very dynamic relationship with a person who's on the move. And your whole life needs to be on the move. It's not about getting in the state of grace, going through the sacraments, and then trying to maintain and keep out of trouble until you die and get to heaven after a lengthy stay in purgatory. It's really about a dynamic journey that's the most exciting journey imaginable. And it's a literal journey for the disciples. They dropped everything and they walked nonstop around the country with him for 3 years. And I think the recent TV series that is not on TV, but is actually a non-traditional series, The Chosen. I don't know if you've seen The Chosen. The Chosen tries to get this across, and I think they do a really good job. It's almost like Jesus on a 3-year camping trip with these guys. You can't pick up in The Chosen is the arduousness of following Jesus for these guys. I just did the Camino of Santiago. I just walked 18 miles one day, 15 miles another. We average 15 miles a day for 5 days. And I'm in really good shape. Generally, I swim a lot. I run. I work out with weights. Well, this knocked me out, man. I just realized something. You can walk 15 miles, but if you don't practice walking up and down hills and you have to deal with hills, you're in big trouble. So I was sore. I was tired. Well, these guys did 20-mile walks regularly, constantly, for 3 years. And this was part of the, and the heat was unbelievable. Anyway, I'm trying to get this across in this book. Number one, that they were on this dynamic mission, but to be a Christian means to be on the move, and not stagnation. Okay. And truth, truth really means something you can build your life on and rely on. And in this age we have right now, where everything is up for grabs, it's very unstable, destabilizing. And you can see the anxiety, you can see the confusion. In this swirling world, Jesus is a place where you can build your life. He is a person, a rock on which you can build your life. And life is really what it's about. People are all about vitality. Church is not about so much rules, regulations, and arid doctrines. All these things are meant to increase vitality that begins now and it blossoms in eternity, but it's constantly growing, or should be growing, if we're deepening our relationship with Jesus. So anyway, that kind of dynamism is kind of the emphasis of the book, because I really do believe it's the emphasis of the Christian life, honestly, that's often missed.
So as you mentioned, as you were describing your book, it weaves together material from all four Gospels. It doesn't just focus on one. It weaves together all four. What were the challenges of this approach?
Well, the challenges were that I couldn't follow the chronology or the sequence of one Gospel. And I just point something out to everybody. You may know this, you may not know this, but we really can't know the exact chronology of the public ministry of Jesus from a historical point of view, because the gospel writers weren't really concerned to insist on this. And Mark seems to be followed by Matthew and Luke. There's a little bit of this debate, you know, some people traditionally thought Matthew was the first one and Mark and Luke followed Matthew. It really doesn't matter, but those three follow a kind of a course of events, or a framework, a literary framework, that's very different from the framework of John, right? And which one is right? Well, it really doesn't matter. They don't really care. The main sequence is he was born, he was baptized, he worked miracles and taught in his public ministry, called disciples. And then it's the sequence of his passion and resurrection. So between that, we really don't know. And so I don't try to reconstruct that. And I think kind of following the four Gospels gives me the liberty not to. But the hard part is, you know, I have to put it into a thematic structure. And so that was a challenge, using the four Gospels, and had to decide, you know, I generally am referring to all four. That's more complicated than just doing a Bible study on John or doing a Bible study on Mark. So, but I think it's richer. And I think that's the way the church actually has always done. The church and its picture of Jesus has taken a composite, kind of a stereoscopic vision, you know, or from all four, if that makes sense, you know.
So in synthesizing the gospel accounts of Jesus, how do you bring together, and what do we learn from the tension between and the differences between, say, the Jesus of Mark's gospel, who seems to deliberately conceal his true identity, and say the Jesus of John's gospel, who more or less wears his divinity on his sleeve?
Yeah, well, I think that it's really helpful. There are two different starting points, first of all, you know, from the vantage point of his humanity, which you find, you know, that's called, Christology from below, where you're kind of starting with Jesus, the man, the carpenter from Nazareth. You find that emphasis a little bit more in Mark particularly. But then you find two writers who follow Mark a great deal, but they start with the birth of Jesus, and they start with the divine origin of Jesus. That's Matthew and Luke. John, obviously, his main focus is the divinity of Jesus. It's one of his main themes. And so it's splat right from the beginning all the way through. Well, you know, it really doesn't matter whether Jesus it seems to me historically, I don't think anybody, there's not a lot of people out there in the scholarly world who would doubt that there is, that Jesus does break it to him gradually in real life, you know? And I think, I think I follow that from the Synoptic Gospels. But I think the church has always resisted the tendency to collapse the mystery and just look at Jesus as a human being, or just look at Jesus as God. And so the real challenge always is to keep the two together. And what I try to do in this book, I think Catholics from about the fourth century have tended to emphasize the divinity of Jesus a little bit to the neglect of his full humanity. And so, you know, I'm trying to bring out that very earthy human experience, you know, Jesus. And I try to bring out something the Catholics often don't know about, and that is the Jewish life of Jesus, Joseph, Mary, the apostles, and how the church's life is such a marvelous in continuity with that. I teach liturgy and sacraments. So when I do teach that on the graduate level, I bring that out even more. But I brought out a bit of that in the book and in the video series.
So speaking of that gradual revelation that is characteristic of the synoptic gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, in your chapter titled The Truth About Jesus, you write that if, quote, if Jesus had explained his identity to his followers all at once, they would not have understood. So when we read the gospels, we have the advantage of knowing where the story's going. How can we recapture the wonder of Jesus's earliest followers at what was unfolding in front of them? How do we empathize with the despair they feel when all seems lost on Golgotha? How do we encounter the resurrected Jesus like we're on the road to Emmaus? For Christians, the Jesus story is one that we grow up with. It's just always there. How do we experience it as though for the first time?
Well, guess what? That's why I wrote the book and we did the series. And so I would just say, you know, I'd plug the series in the book and say, you know, experience it. One of the things I'll also say about the actual series is that there's a study guide, and the study guide really is to help people work it through. And there's small group discussion questions, and those study questions and things can be done as as individuals. They can be done by a couple just doing it together, or they can be done in a small group. But I just got back from San Diego, where because of this series being run in the parish, they asked me to come in person and do a 3-night parish mission. But the excitement that people expressed to me about what they experienced going through this series, there were some that had tears about it. And so it really did. The experience was a vivid rediscovery of Jesus and a sense of wonder. You mentioned wonder. They experienced that kind of wonder in doing the series. I would also make a pitch for the series, The Chosen. Now, The Chosen is not historically accurate in some background and details, and it's historical fiction, as any drama would be, including Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. I think The Passion of the Christ was extraordinary in what it captured. And I think The Chosen is also extraordinary. I recently was in Rome the same time that Jonathan Rumi, the one who plays Jesus, who happens to be a Catholic, a very devout Catholic, by the way, very committed Catholic. But anyway, I had a chance to meet him in Rome. But I think he's done a wonderful job interpreting the person of Jesus. So I would just say that's another suggestion I would make that's absolutely free. People can download an app, watch that for free, and choose to contribute to the production of the next series or not. But it is a beautiful, I think it's very provocative in helping us get there to kind of a different place of you, you know, seeing things a little bit as the disciples did and seeing what their struggle might have been like.
So your book repeatedly makes the point that the incarnation, the Jesus event, takes place within and against the backdrop of history, not mythology. Explain the significance of this distinction.
Mythology happens in a dream time. Yeah, there's no, you know, the mythology is has value. Mythology speaks about and tries to explain basic human reality and divine realities and through stories that happen in a nondescript sort of a time. And most ancient religion that used mythology had a very natural cycle to their worship. A lot was about fertility and about the seasons. It was cyclical kind of approach to things. And really, Judaism is completely different. And our story starts with the people of Israel, where they see God entering into history in real time, in real place. Now, the problem is with Exodus, we're not exactly sure historically which Pharaoh we're talking about. But, you know, roughly, we're talking, depending on what scholars you're looking at, from 1400 to 1200 BC, this really happened. And Abraham's a real person, probably around 1850 BC. That's the best guess we have based on the story. Well, in our creed, we actually date Jesus. And we mentioned Pontius Pilate. And the reason you do that is because people didn't use years so much as they used a ruler to kind of, you know, in the time of Pontius Pilate, in the third year of Tiberius Caesar or whatever, you know, this is the kind of the way people would date things. So Pontius Pilate's not a real hero. We're not proud of Pontius Pilate so much. He's a very minor figure in Roman history. But anyway, it's during his time in a public situation that this happened. It happened not in a corner, as St. Paul says, as he's giving his defense in Acts of the Apostles before a Roman governor. This happened publicly. This is a real event, a real historical person. So, you know, this is what it's all about. God enters into history in a particular time and place. And one of the things that I point out is it's a very remarkable time and place when two cultures are colliding. The Jewish culture of the Middle East, of Palestine, and the new Roman occupiers, who have very different priorities. They're on a collision course. It's kind of like a perfect storm. And Jesus walks into this and upsets both of them, both the Jewish establishment and the Romans. So it's really a very exciting story if you look at it that way, and you look at the stage upon which this very real drama takes place.
Now, realizing that the answer to this question, you know, could be different at any time based on circumstances or season of life, is there one of the four Gospels that you personally find most moving or instructive?
I keep changing. I thought Luke was my favorite because of the emphasis on the Holy Spirit, the great stories that we only have from Luke. Then I start going through a liturgical season where the church is reading Mark, and I say, man, Mark preserves some such vivid dialogue and vivid memories. And he's the guy who preserves some of the Aramaic words of Jesus, like, you know, Tabitha cum, the little girl, get up, and Ephatha, you know, be open. You know, there's an earthiness to Mark. So then I fall in love with Mark. And then, you know, I'm reading John and I'm saying, this is just unbelievable stuff. So I keep going between the four. I'm sorry, I can't give you one favorite. It depends what season you have to ask me. At different times of the year, I'll give you a different answer.
All right. And I've got one more question. You're a 1977 alum. It is your reunion year. Any chance we'll see you on campus next summer?
Oh, my word. I've missed Rhode Island badly. I live in Texas and, you know, particularly in the summer, the beach. So I the last few years, because of COVID, I typically make a retreat at Portsmouth Abbey. And while I'm doing that, I also visit a few people. You know, I have some time alone with God. I go to the beach, I pray with the monks, and then I come up and visit people. So maybe tell me the date, because I didn't know the date. So I'm going to have to try to figure out if I can do this. All right. So do you know offhand, or I'll have to go and read my alum bulletin?
Terrible host. I do not have the dates.
Oh,
off the
man,
top of
I can't
head,
believe but, that, Michael.
This is a great opportunity for me to say that we will put information about reunion in the show notes for anybody
awesome.
Who might be interested.
No, but I'd love to do it. I have one trip abroad in August. I'm hoping it's not going to conflict with that. And if not, I will make my retreat coincide with that as best as I possibly can and get up there. That'd be awesome.
All right. Well, excellent. Marcellino, Dr. Italy, it has been wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're most welcome. And I don't know if you're going to put a link to my website, but the website is simply dritaly.com. So that's dritaly.com. And the Ascension Press site is another place that you can get all the Jesus materials. And that's ascensionpress.com is even a mini site /Jesus, ascensionpress.com/Jesus.
All right. We'll include those in the show notes as well. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Subscribe to the Providence College podcast in all the usual places, including iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, as well as your smart speaker. If you like what you hear, please review and share with others. Thanks for listening, and go Friars.